Hey, you are listening to The Workplace Leader. This is the podcast where we go behind the scenes of corporate real estate, talking to industry experts about how they shape the next generation workplace.
I'm your host, Sabine M., and in today's episode, I'm speaking with Rolf Suhlen. Rolf is a corporate real estate advisor at Equinor. So hi, everyone. I'm speaking today with Rolf Suhlen. We got connected through some of my colleagues and we had a really good prep conversation. And I'm really sad we actually didn't record that. So we're trying to replicate it today and make it even better. So hi, Rolf.
Hi.
Happy to have you here. For everyone out there, can you tell us what your role is at Equinor? And also for the people who are not that familiar with the Nordics and the company, can you tell us what Equinor does?
Absolutely. Now, Equinor is a Norwegian energy company founded when we found oil in the late 60s. We're an energy company and we produce energy from oil and gas and now wind. Equinor is located in 30 different countries. It's a major supplier of gas to the UK and mainland Europe. Now, Equinor is now in a major shift from oil and gas to renewables and is establishing as a major developer of wind parks in the UK and the US. So my role in this is that I'm heading up the workplace team. Obviously, workplace in a large company like that is all about optimizing utilization, create good workspaces for all our offices globally.
So you told me before that within your family, you're kind of have an exotic professional background. Can you dive into that a little?
It's not that exotic, but three generations before me, they were all architects. So I was practically heading that way, but I decided to do business instead. So I moved to the UK and I've got a business degree from University of Newcastle. So I'm the rebel in the family who went the other way.
Yeah, and then you came back to workplace management.
And then I came back because real estate, you know, it's in my DNA. Real estate is really in my DNA. You know, my mother, my grandfather, my grand-grandfather, you know, the real architects, developers. So yeah, so with the business degree, I came back to real estate, I did.
Bringing another side of it to the table, because that's important as well, to look at business.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, coming back to Equinor, we've learned what the company does. How big is the real estate portfolio?
We are located spread worldwide in about 30 countries. In my portfolio, there is about 110 separate buildings. And that is anything from, you know, offices, bases, plants, factories, everything in our portfolio. And we have approximately 1 million square meters, which is not, you know, globally, it's not much, but we're really spread out there. So we have the largest offices. They are in Norway, in Oslo, Bergen, Stavanger, Trondheim. And then we have international locations. We've got offices in London, Houston, and Rio de Janeiro. So on a global basis, we're approximately 20,000 full-time employees, and approximately 15,000 are working onshore. Since we're an offshore company, you know, we tend to divert between offshore and onshore workers.
Yeah.
Approximately 15,000 comes to the office, or should come to the office every day.
They are not right now, I'm assuming.
And not.
But if they were to return to the office, what's the most common workplace configuration that you have? How is the workplace configured and set up?
Yeah. You know, we're pretty traditional when it comes to office setup. Approximately two-thirds is open landscape. So we've got a policy of one size fits all. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to come a little bit back to that later on. Approximately one-third is cell offices and two-thirds is open landscape. And then obviously as a technical company in oil and gas, we have all the special configurations for space with regards to offshore activities. You know, we are remotely controlling platforms offshore from onshore. And we have, you know, all the production and we have all the plants and we have the logistics. You know, we have helicopters, boats, everything moving around. So there's a lot of special configurations within our office space as well to control everything that goes on in the value stream of our oil and gas company. Yeah.
And then how is the corporate real estate team structured? You said you're handling 1 million square meters and you do have then responsibility for the variety of space types, or do you have office specialists and plant specialists?
So corporate real estate is about, we're 15 employees in corporate real estate. Our mandate is to manage the portfolio. That's basically our mandate. We are separated up in teams. So we've got one transaction team, we've got a project team, we've got management team, we've got an art team. There's a lot of art on our walls. So we have a specialist when it comes to arts. And then we have workplace. So, and we're all spread out. We're all located in different locations. So, you know, when it comes to virtual working, we've been working virtually now for the last several years. And in the organization, you know, corporate real estate is a tactical unit where we've got FM as an operational unit, as a sister unit. So that's how the corporate real estate team is set up for now.
Anyways, your co-workers or your immediate colleagues are not with you in Norway. Have you been to an office anywhere, anytime the past 5 years? Just wondering, or if it's always been remote.
Before COVID, I was on the run every week. So I saw a lot of airports. And as we've got, you know, things are happening now with the green shift as well, going to renewables. Obviously, you know, we're closing down oil and gas locations and we're opening up new green locations when it comes to wind farms. So there's a lot of activities when it comes to transactions, which I'm also involved in. So, you know, anything from South America, North America, UK, mainland, Europe, and Norway, with the four large locations we have in Norway as well. So it includes a lot of traveling, obviously. So sometimes you just have to be there. So things we thought we had to do in presence and be physically there, you know, we've learned for the last 12 months that we can actually do it virtually, which is good. So, you know, post-COVID, I might not travel that much.
Yeah. So you did see a lot of offices, just not your designated desk before.
Yes. It's all about the culture as well, because Equinor is such a widespread company. So, you know, for me, heading up workplace, for me to know what goes on, what do they do? What kind of tasks do they solve? How do they work? Do they work in teams? Do they sit in offices? Do they work with spreadsheets? Are they actually interacting, you know, as a project around a table? I need to know that. And the only way to figure that out is actually being out there.
I agree. Having the conversations and learn on site, see with your own eyes.
Exactly.
That helps tremendously. Now, I want to jump on the train because you mentioned green energy. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, you must be looking for new locations and disposing of old ones. What are you looking for when you're going on site selection? Are there certain criteria you're ticking off now? And have they shifted to become more sustainability driven as well?
Yeah, sustainability is something we signed out in our real estate strategy in 2019. So we said any new lease, because we lease our real estate, any new lease should have some kind of certificate, whether it's a BREEAM certificate or something else. And we should always look at sustainability. You know, the values in our company is low carbon, for example. So when it comes to footprint, that is really important for us when we look at new space. But obviously, you know, as in any company, it's all about how many people will be on that location and the geography. Does it have to be in the dead center of the city? Does it have to be on the coastline? Does it have to have some kind of logistical center? You know, there's a lot of things that we need to take into the business case, but sustainability is one of them. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then now that you've touched upon it, the last 12 months have revealed that a lot of the work actually doesn't need to happen on site. Does that have an impact on your footprint of the buildings? Are you expecting space reduction? And also, are you building that in already in the site search you're doing?
We try. So what we do now, what we've seen now, because our company is not any different from any other large company when it comes to utilization of space. We have a turn up at the office in a range of 50-60% every day. But every time we go into a new business case, looking at new space, our space norm says that we should have so-and-so many square meters per full-time employee, which means that if we get a demand or a request from the business saying, look, we're 200 people, we need a new location because we're going to build a wind farm. Now, immediately, we would just take that number, 200 full-time employees, you know, time it up with the space norm that we have, which is 20 square meters per full-time employee. And we would, you know, call the agents and say, so have you got something of this size in this location? And then going down to the details, we would look at, you know, everything else. So should we look at splitting the location? Should we look into activity base where we will see that, you know, most of the people will not be in the office every day. They will probably be out, you know, doing something else. So we have some kind of system in the madness. But initially, it's all about, you know, the 20 square meters per full-time employee.
And then you would take into account looking into the future that the 56% turn-up rate might be even less potentially.
Absolutely. Because what we've seen now, you know, even myself included, seeing that, you know, all that travel that I did, all that, you know, I have to be there. I have to go to that steering committee meeting. I have to meet that manager. I have to sit down with that country manager to understand what they want and how they want it. So we've learned that virtual first will take down all that travel, which means that all the space that we need now, you know, take our locations in London. There's a lot of full-time employees in London, but at the same time, it's a hub for our activities because we have a lot of people coming in from our global locations and they tend to come into London. So if we have a, you know, some kind of big event, instead of doing it in Oslo in Norway, we would do it in London because it's easier for people from the global offices to come into London than anywhere else. Which means that, you know, for those special events, we have rigged an office that can facilitate that. But on a daily basis, you know, with a 50, 60% turn up, there's a lot of dead space sitting there every day. So this is part of our business case as well. We would definitely look into some kind of ratio when it comes to the 20 square meters on the full-time employees. We would probably say we would probably go into 70, 80% coverage when it comes to desks. Instead of one-to-one, there will be, you know, 0.8 per full-time employee. And we will also look upon how we can set up the offices to make sure that when we have these big groups coming in, there are facilities to manage that. But on a daily basis, it shouldn't look empty. You should know, it shouldn't just be dead space. Yeah, those are things that we are looking into.
In a couple of my other conversations, people were envisioning having less and less desk space and actually more providing these collaboration areas and meeting rooms. Is that something that you think will happen for Equinor as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've tried, actually. Again, we've tried to do this. But we see there is a challenge when it comes to implementing new ways of working because it's really easy to get the initiative approved because it shows in the business case, it shows a saving. So anything that we come along to our CFO and say, look, it looks like we can save some money if we, you know, if we lease less space or if we save some on the furniture, if we find some kind of model that will not create the large space that we normally have. So we will get, of course, go ahead, do it. Yeah. But then when it comes to implementation, the implementation phase or where you need to train your employees, you need to learn how to work. If you look upon activity based, for example, you need to learn how to work in an office that is based on activity-based work style. Now, when it comes to implementation, we have such a big turnaround in our company because we're constantly changing to where we need energy, how we produce energy. Now we're shifting from oil and gas, which is, you know, very traditionally, to wind and renewables, which is changing a lot of our people. So the full-time employee number in our company is very stable. That fluctuates about 5%. But the type of people that are within these numbers, they fluctuate a lot. So every year, yeah, we have a major turnaround of how we sit and where we sit, how we work, what we do. So implementing activity-based, implementing free seating, implementing desk sharing, implementing different ways of working or new ways of working is very good on paper. When it comes to implementing into a company that is in constant change, it's really hard because we don't have the time to train our employees or train our personnel into how that is supposed to work. So it is a challenge. Yeah.
I remember as well that the first pilots I was around for activity-based working, it was just so hard. It was really hard and painful a little to have all these conversations and explain to people why this is actually a good thing. I mean, it makes sense for everyone if you tell them you save space, you optimize cost and everything. I'm just like, yeah, sure. But still, I want my desk because that's what I enjoy having. Yeah. And then without having the ability to show it, it's so difficult to, I mean, if you haven't experienced it, you don't know.
No.
I mean, it's the same with tasting new food, right? We're very, or I'm very quick at saying, I don't like that. And then I don't try, right?
Exactly. So implementing the new ways of working is hard. So, you know, for the business cases that we do now, saying now that, yes, we will need less space in the future or post-COVID, I can always say that that's the hypothesis. But it, in practice, how will we implement it? Now, one thing we can work it with is obviously, you know, the general utilization of our space. And that's a global phenomenon. That's not, you know, special for Equinor. That 50, 60, 70% turns up in the office every day. That's a global phenomenon. You know, And that is because we have the lease structures. We go into 10, 15 years leases, you know, with the landlords. And to get the right price, we need to prolong the lease. And at the same time, balancing the flexibility that we need. As I said, you know, we are a constantly changing organization. Yeah, people are turning around, doing different things all the time. So with the real estate market and combining that with an ever-changing organization is hard. And we're always talking about flexibility. We're always talking about space optimization, you know, all these buzzwords that we love in corporate real estate. But when it comes to actually implementing it and see how our colleagues fit in, that's when the trouble starts.
It's like everybody needs to be on board for it to actually work, because if there's a lot of frustration and resistance towards it, you'll never get that plane to fly.
No, exactly.
Yeah, in pictures again. That's a difficult step to take because you need to have buy-in from everyone in the company and ideally from senior management as well, living up to what you set out to do. And then unfortunately, in my experience, a lot of the times politics comes in the way, and especially in that level of management, there is then resistance to new initiatives because you do lose your corner office. So it's a bit of a trap,
I'd say. It is.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to real estate goals, you've mentioned that you have a sustainability agenda. And I'm believing that the flexibilization of spaces might be on your agenda as well. Yes. What other initiatives are driving the real estate strategy?
Now, the real estate strategy, because we're in a process now where we're going to make a new concept design for our offices. And what we see, we have a new contender, which is called the home office. Yeah.
Yes.
So, which means that you know, even though I wasn't competing about people coming into the office and having a good space to work and good facilities, now I've got a major, if not a competition, but, you know, people and employees that has the possibility and ability to work from home or remote work will opt for that as much as they can. Looking at the European countries, I mean, looking at just take the differences between UK and Norway. Now, the Norway demography, which means that, you know, we're located, we've got pretty much, you know, good, stable internet. We've got comfort. We've got space. We've got good HSE when it comes to living standards. Going to the UK, we might find different. You know, our location in London says that, you know, there's a lot of people there that has got a tiny little apartment and it's not a good place to be, which means that they crave to go to the office. Now, coming back to the question is the things we need to balance now is that we need to look into the competitor, which is the home office. We need to add value to the office. We need to find and figure out what makes me go to the office. Is it because of the technical equipment? Is it because of the collaboration zones? Is it because that's where I meet my colleagues? Is it because HSE is so much better? Is it, you know, go to South America, you will find that, you know, even the internet is bad. So you cannot be working from home. You need to go to the office. So what we're looking into now is for the new concept design is to find what adds value to the office space. Now, looking at office space as not just a building, but as a strategic asset in the company. Now, in our company, we're talking about strategic assets. If I want to drill a well offshore, we need to lease or hire an oil rig, a drilling rig. Yeah. To get the people onto that platform, we need a helicopter. To get all the equipment we need a boat. So we have all these strategic assets in the company. Now, up until now, we're not looking upon the office as a strategic asset. It's just a place where we store our employees. It's just a place for them to be. So corporate real estate has been much about getting enough space, and then the people need to figure out how they're going to solve doing their task and daily work themselves, okay? Even though, you know, workplace, we're in there, we're making sure that they're good desks, good, you know, chairs, and sufficient when it comes to meeting rooms, focus rooms, canteen, facility services, and all that. But we're not really in there and helping them to add value to that place. And that's one of the things we're looking into now. If we can identify what values do we need? Because if you look upon yourself or myself, if I say, you know what, next week, 5 days, out of 5 days, I've got a lot of meetings, which means that I'm not going to go to the office just to sit in a focus room and have a lot of meetings. So I'll rather be at home. So Monday and Tuesday, I'll be at home because I've got my screens, I've got my, you know, camera and everything, good, you know, chair and everything. Now, the question is, when it comes to Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, I need to have some kind of collaboration. I need to do some kind of analysis. I need to do some kind of task that is important that I have the right equipment, the right colleagues, the right environment to do this. Yeah. So the question is, how can we look upon the footprint of our office and say, first of all, we don't need all that space. Second of all, how can we make that space a place where we need to go and do stuff when we are not at home? And finding that balance, finding those values, finding that, you know, those items that adds value to the office, which means that when I'm talking about competition, because in Norway, you know, it's really easy to be at home. You can even take your laptop, you go to the slopes, you can go to your chalet, and you'll sit there and do work, yeah? And it's good because the internet infrastructure, everything is good. So for Scandinavians, we will probably, you know, we will take that opportunity to work remotely. So I need to make sure that if we are going to have an office, it needs to be a strategic asset and it needs to add value, which means that I will say, I will go to the office because what I do will have a better outcome. What I do will have a higher quality than just sitting at home, which means that, you know, you go away from the traditional looking into full-time employees, square meters, location. You know, that's the travel we've started now. We've had all the internal discussions and we're about to embark on that travel to see if we can identify those values that we need in the office as a strategic asset.
Yeah, it's all so true. And just as this crisis has turned the tables for corporate real estate, for people to realize it's just, as you said it so nicely, it's not just a place where you store employees and they work away. No. If that were true, I actually had that theory like 1.5 years ago. I was like, in corporate real estate, the success metrics, it's square meters per employee, desks per square meter, cost per square meter, and employee. Mm-hmm. If that were true, if that was everything that the success of an office entails, everybody work from home, these numbers are going to be amazing because you don't have to spend money on the building. But the truth is, nobody ever even considered this because there is a value in the office as a destination for people to come to. But now the question is, how do you measure that? Because it's so much harder than using the numbers that you anyways have in your financial system.
Exactly. I think that's really interesting. When we look upon, as I said, you know, as a strategic asset and see how we can optimize and utilize, not just by, as you say, square meters per full-time employee and cost per square meter. So new KPIs. And what are those KPIs going to be?
Are you invested in that? Checking out what can be done?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we are always looking into new ways of working and not just new ways of working, but as a technology company, the competition that our company has is that somebody can produce energy cheaper or with less effort. So we always have to be in the forefront. So as a corporate culture, we always look upon how we can optimize, how we can, you know, run things more smoothly or with less, whether it's going to be cost, manpower, or remotely. And at the same time, you know, so that comes down to corporate real estate as well. We always get the questions from management saying, so how can we do this better? And looking into the, you know, the technology that has evolved now the last couple of years when it comes to corporate real estate tools is fascinating. And we are really looking into that as well, seeing how can the new digital tools help us? Is there any disruptive technology? Is there new ways of thinking when it comes to what kind of tools do we need? Because looking into, I've got an old tool, and I'm saying an old tool because we started this tool 20 years ago, and it has evolved with the company. But for now, you know, it's a very good tool for me to take out how many people do we have in this location? And what is the utilization when it comes down to full-time employees and desks and the lease contract? What do we pay per square meters now? That's very traditional thinking because I can take out all the reports and I also have the tool to say, okay, if we get 50 more colleagues coming in from another business area, I will be able to fit them in this corner. Yeah. But the question is, should I use that tool in the future? You know, if I want to do other types of analysis, other types of utilization, other types of space management, what kind of tools will I need? Yeah. Take disruptive technology when it comes to other businesses. They've come a long way. Take the car industry. Yeah. What has happened after Tesla came in and said, look, we're going to rock this business? There's a lot of things happening and the rest of the industry needs to come along after that. And that will also be obviously, you know, when it comes to the real estate industry, because now there's a lot of cowboy builders out there and there's a lot of landlords having a lot of square meters. And the only thing they want is to generate return on investment. And then we come along and we say, look, we're a big global company. We've got a lot of money. We're producing oil and gas and we need a place in this city. Fine. we'll give it to you, but it's going to cost. So what happens in, you know, down the road in a couple of years when the landlords and the builders and the end user, which is us, is actually sitting around the table when this journey starts, saying that, you know what, we need a strategic asset that can add value to what we do. How will the building industry and how will the landlords facilitate that instead of me going into, you know, as a small mouse in a big market saying, I need space? And that dynamics is also, it's back to ancient times. We've always had landlords, yeah? And we've always had people coming to lease the property. And that cooperation hasn't changed either. So that is also interesting when I'm talking about tools, when I'm talking about how we as a company should look upon the strategic asset and how we utilize the strategic asset. Will that affect the real estate market? Or will we just, you know, bump our head into the wall and it won't work?
Actually, it's funny that she mentioned that because I had a conversation this morning with the other side, with someone who is more in the within the corporate side, with the provider side of it.
Yeah, exactly.
So the dark side, no. From that conversation, I got the feeling that I don't want to say they're afraid, but they're seeing the market turn. They see, I mean, their spaces, although they are rented out now, are not utilized, and they can envision themselves or project themselves into the future, seeing the lease end and seeing spaces handed back. And now they actually want to understand the future as well. They are taking a toll into how can we anticipate what our tenants are going to do? How can we improve the space offering so that we don't have a lot of vacancy? Because in Switzerland, office vacancy is actually quite high. Don't know about Norway. Mm. So they need to make sure that their properties are still rented out, because otherwise there's no return on invest. And then their business model goes to shatters.
Exactly. But historically, you know, every time there's been an introduction of a new model or a new technology, the fright of new technology when it comes to manpower, every time there's new technology, everybody's talking about, oh, we're going to lose our jobs and we're going to be, you know, we're going to be out of work. But the point is that every time, historically, for the last 200 years, new technology has been introduced, the number of employees has increased. Yeah. Because in the whole value chain, we do different stuff. Yeah. And you can go back to, you know, take France 200 years ago. Yeah. The Renaissance. Yeah. There was too many people, too much cash. And what happened? Yeah. We had art. Yeah. The development of art, which is fantastic. So without that period in time in France 200 years ago, we wouldn't have all the fine arts that we have today, I would say. So we shouldn't be afraid of embracing new technology or change. But when it comes to, you know, the landlords and the builders, they should also take part in this, looking into how can we turn our square meters into a strategic asset, which is highly competitive, which will make, you know, any company coming into the city, they will call me first because I've got the, you know, best strategic asset when it comes to corporate functions.
I'm actually a big fan of making informed decisions as well, also on the landlord side, because in the end, that means less resources are wasted. Yeah. And I mean, landlords need to make decisions. Corporate real estate needs to make decisions.
Absolutely.
When you are making decisions, who is sitting with you on the table? Who needs to sign off on it? And in that same realm, what do you think are the most difficult decisions to make, and which are the ones that you sign off on easily?
Yeah. Now, if we start with the second question first, you know, the difficulty, you know, the more people it involves in my company, it's not my company, but in my company, the company that I work. But now, the more people involved, the more difficult it gets.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So as, and especially as a Scandinavian company, as a Norwegian company, trade unions, HSE, always, you know, safety first. That's our motto. So when it comes into changes, upgrades, reconfigurations, decisions being made, it's always about safety first, end users, and how we can please everybody in a good way. Which means that if I am to make a decision that involves a few people, it's pretty much straightforward. As I mentioned earlier on, if we went to implement a new strategy document, that could go pretty straightforward through a decision. But when it comes to the implementation of the actual things we should do in that strategy, that's when you meet all the people, and then it gets really difficult. So I would say, you know, top one when it comes to difficulty, when it comes to complexity, when it comes to the more people it involves, the harder it gets. It's just like a bureaucracy. It's like a democracy. Yeah, we need to have all the discussions. We all need to agree, or a majority needs to agree before we can make decisions. So that is one of the things that is hard in a large company, but it's also one of the things that it makes it exciting, because you will be challenged in so many ways from different angles, which means that if you like that environment, it's exciting. So when it comes to involvement, obviously, you know, end user is a big stake in our company, because they are the ones who's coming into the office, using the space every day. If we are to reconfigure a control room where they're going to sit 24/7 and control an offshore platform, obviously, you know, we need to build it to their spec and their need. But when it comes to the actual decision makers, obviously, as a big corporate function, it's CFO. He's got the wallet, he's got the credit card, and it needs to go through all the levels until it hits corporate real estate. So when it comes to making decisions, obviously, you know, as we read in several papers, it's all about the mandate given, but you don't have the wallet to make the decision locally. Yeah. So there is a gap between the CFO saying that, you know, we need to save money on our portfolio, and he's pointing at corporate real estate saying, look, it's your task to make sure that we optimize the portfolio. But when it comes to actually doing stuff with the portfolio, we need to ask for permission. And that's, you know, three or four steps along the way. And in the middle, you have another management level, which is in between, because they don't have the interest of the CFO, but they don't have the interest of the real estate portfolio either, which means that they have their own KPIs that they follow, which means that, again, you know, it involves not just many people, but it involves different levels. So that complicates decisions as well, being corporate real estate in a large global company.
Yeah, it's an extra loop that you have to take getting everyone on board. I think that was one of the struggles that I had with the implementation of activity-based working in the beginning as well. The business was saying, I don't want it, and now you want me to pay for it? What? Because at the starting line, it's more expensive to build out that noise activity-based working environment, because you typically provide more fancy things, nicer collaboration areas, and that's more expensive than the standard desk. So yes, that was another pain point I do remember.
It is, you know, we have a lot of those stories because we've had a lot of pilots trying out new environment, new, you know, setup, new different kind of layouts when it comes to offices. And, you know, time and time again, we tend to spend a lot of money on a corner of the office saying, look, we're going to do something really exciting here. You're going to have all the latest equipment. We're going to have a layout that is really radical when it comes to, you know, informal meeting spaces, collaboration space, and the mix of how many meeting rooms, focus rooms, open landscape you need. Now, what tends to happen every time is that we take a business unit and we put them into this new exciting place. And then we come back after 6 months and ask, so does it work? You know, are you more happy than everybody else? Or do you deliver more quality? Are you more creative? Does this new environment help? And, you know, 90% comes back and say, you know what? It's just the feeling of being in a special place compared to my colleagues who's in the neighbor building. So I've got better furniture, I've got nicer paint on the wall, you know, and that's the kind of comments we get back. And that's rather scary when we don't see that they come back and they say, now we deliver more quality, we are much more creative, and, you know, the new collaboration zones really makes us up to speed when it comes to what we do. We don't get that feedback because they take their traditional thinking into the new space, and then they think it's a little bit awkward. It's a little bit loud because it's much open space, which means that when everybody is on Teams, Skype, Google, you know, when they sit on their desk, acoustics is a major issue. So for us, we've spent a lot of money to try and develop new layouts, but we tend to get back that, you know, either they're happy with the furnitures because they're a little bit more fancy than everything else, but we don't get that, you know, saying that the quality of what we do is better, which means that thinking from a strategic perspective, saying that, you know what, our real estate should be a strategic asset. And a strategic asset is there to increase quality. You know, the goal hasn't been reached. It's just back to the garage where people sit.
Now, if I were to, or I'm actually am going to ask you personally, what should the future work environment look like that you want to go there on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday? We had that before.
Exactly. And we've been through some of it. But one of the things that I miss when it comes to office Because work, as I said, you know, historically, we've been going to work for decades. And where's the intuitive space? Now, I'm going to explain that by saying that, you know, if you go into a hotel room, yeah, you don't have to be explained now. This is the bed. If you raise the duvet, you will find a mattress and you can sleep, yeah? And this is the nightstand. You can put your, you know, and this is a desk.
You find the Bible in it.
Exactly. You'll find the Bible in the drawer. And, you know, this is the bathroom. That's a shower. If you take off your clothes, go into the shower, you will get wet. Now, you'll find, you don't have to be explained down to detail how to utilize a hotel room, yeah? Whether it's in South America or Europe, it's intuitive. You'll come into the space and you'll have everything you need to get rest, to work, to get clean and prepare for the next day. Now, if you look upon that being intuitive, because it's in our as human beings, but we've been going to the office, we've been going to work for so many years. Why isn't the office an intuitive place to be? When I need to do some work, why isn't it intuitive for me to go to this space to do this kind of task? You know, we tend to complicate by saying that, you know what, a lot of my meetings could have been done on the phone at walking, yeah? But I tend to go into a focus room, log on, you know, making sure all the technology works, spend another, you know, 10, 15 minutes to make sure that everything works, and then go straight into the meeting and then out again. But what has happened? Was that a good meeting? Did we raise the quality of what we're doing? Does it add value? So, you know, I don't know if you get my point, but, you know, the office space should be more intuitive. And that's all about psychology and workplace psychology and organizational psychology. But the word intuitive should be more present when we develop a new workspace.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. It should be more in tune with our preferences somehow. So I have to say, actually, when there was the first lockdown last year in March, and it was in Switzerland, it was really nice weather. I got a total kick out of it because all afternoon I would sit on the balcony with the laptop in the sunshine and go. I mean, I worked the same way. It was just that I could be outside. And that was something that I had always, all my working life, found fault with, that I couldn't be outside and do work because I love being outside when there's appropriate weather, of course.
Exactly.
I have to wrap it up, a couple of lost questions. One is, who do you consult with and trust for advice related to? I mean, you're a corporate real estate advisor yourself, but who do you exchange with as well?
Yeah. With a lot of people. But when it comes to me as an advisor in Equinor, I mean, we've always had a policy to utilize external expertise and not to have too much in-house manpower. That's one of the, you know, the theories about Equinor. We should employ external companies to build external companies to, you know, make sure that there's a lot of work out there. So corporate real estate and Equinor, we have a lot of cooperation through a supply network of real estate advisors when it comes to corporate real estate, when it comes to workplace, when it comes to architecture, when it comes to project. So we tend to, I mean, I've got a major network around me that I'm, you know, in constant dialogue with. And also, you know, looking at your own company, look at T, which is, you know, producing reports, you know, having chats, having podcasts, that kind of input as well is really important because that's when you hear the people that you don't call yourself, but somebody that comes in and you can say, wow, that was interesting. You know, I'd never read or see or hear that unless I was following your podcast, for example, which is also important. Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that, of course. Now, we've touched upon a couple of challenges in corporate real estate. If you could magically solve any one of those, what would it be?
I would have to go to the real estate market and I would say historic learning. Because thinking about it, you know, mankind has been building since we left the caves. But we still managed to deliver buildings full of technical errors and bad design. Thousands and thousands of years of technical errors and bad design. So if I would, you know, magically solve any real estate problem, I would say, you know, if we could establish common drivers for design and construction to increase end user experience, as I said, you know, focusing on the strategic assets, making sure that the real estate market was more in line with the strategic asset perspective. Because now I think there's too much sub-optimizing in each step of the real estate value chain to create financial gain. You know, for me, I need to save money, the landlord needs to make money, and somebody else wants to, you know, there's too many silos and there's too many financial KPIs that makes that collaboration across difficult.
Yeah. And that's coming from someone whose entire family has been an architect.
Exactly. So I'm part of the problem here.
But I would actually say one of my first jobs, I had a lot of discussions around financials within the company because we leased out the space to the business units, and the negotiations I had for internal money shuffling around, I mean, that was just purely time wasted.
I'd say.
Exactly. Now in retrospective, I learned a lot from it, but...
Oh, you do. Absolutely. You learn.
Life could have been easier.
Exactly.
Okay. Now that I heard that you enjoy the podcast, who else would you like to hear on it so I can reach out and make them come?
Oh, that's a good question. Now, I don't think I'm going to mention any names or any companies, but what I find really interesting is the evolution of PropTech innovation clusters. Because the PropTech innovation clusters, they really try to break down the barriers and increase collaboration in the value chain of real estate. Now, they are focused on developing disruptive technology to create some kind of revolutions in a trade that is often stuck in repeat. I mean, even in Norway, in a tiny city called Bergen, where I'm located, we have a large PropTech innovation cluster environment. And that comes from other businesses as my own, oil and gas. Now, cost and efficiency of oil and gas equipment and processes has come drastically down, you know, through innovation clusters. So if you want to, you know, continue your podcast interviews, my recommendation would look into the PropTech innovation clusters.
Yeah. So Rolf, thank you very much. It was, I even want to say, more, even better than our introduction conversation. So
was,
nobody has missed out.
It's been great fun.
Thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode of The Workplace Leader, there's more. Go visit our blog and have a look at some of the other topics we have covered. Currently, you can download your own decision-making canvas, for example. Or tune into our next episode of The Workplace Leader.